And she said, Arnold Robinson is dead. And I started crying. And I still, you know, it's such a strange thing to think about because I know what those words mean now. I've experienced death as an adult of my own mother, of really close friends. And hearing those words and having those feelings at 5 or 6 years old, they're a little different. So I know I had an immediate physical, emotional reaction, but it wasn't until years later that I fully understood what that meant. This, to me at the time, just meant, oh, my daddy's not around anymore. That's bad.
Did she explain that he was shot?
I don't remember in the moment, and a young child's memory is a little fudgy. What I do remember is actually not knowing how he died when she told me, but coming across, we had a big file cabinet in our house, a big black file cabinet, I think 5 drawers, very, very deep, smooth rolling wheels with these chrome label holders you could slide an index card into. And we had a file subsection within it called Vital Statistics. And I remember it so specifically because statistics was spelled with an X at the end because my mom thought that was fun. And I used to think it was Vital Statistics. And so I was going through the Vital Statistics file one afternoon, as a kid does, rifling through papers, and I found my father's death certificate. And I had never known in that detail what had happened. And death certificates are just, it was my first time I'd ever seen one. I haven't seen very many in my life, but the death certificate from a gunshot wound is a horrible, horrible representation of mortality. And it's cold and it's clinical, and you basically watch the body shutting down in text.
You quote it in the book. You want to read it?
Here's what the death certificate said. Bullet wounds of chest, lungs, spine, and spinal cord, followed by paraplegia and bronchopneumonia.
Right.
Yeah. That's, I don't know, it's just, it's a strange medical dark poetry. And what I had understood as he was shot was translated into something much more troubling, yet also richer and just strange. So I don't remember knowing in the very moment that he was shot. I know I found out in the intervening years. And then coming across this document was sort of another shock to my system of just what that actually meant.
So what did it do to your sense of, like, violence in the neighborhood, mm-hmm. how drugs can actually lead to death? You know, it's the kind of, like, potentially scared straight type of thing that, you know, a lot of parents and law officers and stuff try to, like, instill in young people. This is the consequence.
Right.
So, like, at age 6, your father shot to death in a drug deal. What impact did that have in terms of how one goes about living in the world?
So, I don't think it was an explicit, like, red flag in my head. I was a nerdy kid. I was a studious kid. I did have friends as well. I wasn't totally isolated and alone. But I was in the gifted and talented program in the public school system and did extracurricular activities, playing bass in the D.C. Youth Orchestra program, Boy Scouts. And again, this was in part my mother just throwing activities at me to keep me drowning in busyness.
Keep you off the streets.
Exactly. So I wouldn't have time, literally didn't have time to do any crime because I had assignments backed up from all these different activities. You know, and it wasn't just a matter of not having time. It was being engaged in things that actually stimulated the mind. And I think that probably lifted any burden off of me where it might have been so easy to kind of fall into the statistical future that lay before me of hold this bag, deliver this thing, and then look out for that, and then collect this. It just didn't interest me as much. And it was never this loud voice of my dead father saying, don't do this, but that probably had a subconscious effect at least.
In your book, you, in talking about growing up during the crack epidemic and that epidemic affecting your neighborhood, you write, you compare it to the HBO series The Wire. And you write, when the HBO series The Wire came out, I recognized so much of what was on my TV screen from my memories of my own neighborhood. We had everything The Wire had except for universal critical acclaim and the undying love of white people who saw it.
That's true. We did not have the ratings or the Netflix popularity that The Wire did.
So how did the crack epidemic affect your neighborhood?
It was, I think the first thing I remember was not being...
And do you know one of the reasons why I'm so interested? I remember, like, during the height of the crack epidemic, like, always thinking, what's it like for the kids who are growing up in this?
Yeah,
yeah. You know, and like now we can talk to the kids because they're adults and find out, you know?
Exactly. No, let me, I remember not being able to go outside. I remember specifically not being allowed to sit on our front stoop. And on the weekends, I used to sometimes sit on the stoop and eat breakfast outside, especially in the summertime. We didn't have air conditioning. It's hot. It's a nice day. And there was a period of time when that was no longer allowed. I remember not playing outside as much and being told, go to so-and-so's house, but stay inside. There's this sort of captivity. And I also have a very particular memory of watching some of my friends walk down that road that I didn't walk down. And there was a family of brothers who lived across the street from us. And there were at least three of them. I'm pretty sure there were four. And you could just watch them almost like that image of evolution, which shows kind of a hunched over ape evolving into man. You could watch the older brother get into the drug business and then the next one and then the next one and then the youngest one. And it was just, that was the pattern established. And I remember when those guys used to deliver pizza for Domino's and that was their way of making money and that was their job. And they had rigged up a lawnmower engine to their 10-speed bikes to turn them into motorcycles and would zip down 16th Street. I lived at 16th and Newton. And I thought that was so cool. And then I remember when those same kids set up a lemonade stand. And then I remember when their jackets got nicer, their boots got nicer, and they were selling drugs. And that was a, I don't know, such a strong memory in my head of, well, they used to do that, and now they do this. And I used to be able to do this, and now I can't do that. Those are some of the effects I remember kind of growing up in a neighborhood that was being corrupted and poisoned by crack cocaine.
In seventh grade, you moved to a different neighborhood.
Yeah, at the end of seventh grade, we moved out of Northwest Washington, D.C. to Tacoma Park, Maryland. And essentially, it had become too much for my mother. And I think it was very stressful for her raising me. She was raising me alone, so she was working a lot of hours to pay for all these things, including private school at the time. And I was pretty cool with it because, again, as a kid, whatever you grow up in feels normal. So this is where my friends are. This is the neighborhood I know. I'm not feeling so dramatic about the situation. But as a parent, you're probably just seeing risk, 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 risk everywhere. So we moved out to a more suburban area. Still a black neighborhood, actually, but we had a little plot of land, freestanding house.
Did you like it?
I did like it. I didn't spend much time there. And it was quiet. It was quieter than I was used to, especially growing up at a major intersection in a city.
Mm-hmm.
You have cops and ambulances and people yelling, and that's a sign of life. So we moved out to near a park, and there's deer that run across the street. That's actually a little alarming. You know, even for a kid who was a Boy Scout and went camping, I wasn't used to sleeping in silence. So the first while was a bit different. And then I did so many school activities that home really was where I slept and not much more. But it was nice.
What kind of work was your mother doing to support you?
So she evolved a lot throughout her life. I think she started doing domestic work. And then she was a secretary. And then she was a paralegal. Then she never got a full college degree, but she took a lot of classes at University of the District of Columbia and at Montgomery Community College and ended up essentially learning computer programming. And taking, you know, sliding from the paralegal department within the federal government to the programming department. And I don't remember what level grade she made in the government, but it was a pretty good one. So she worked for something called the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. It's a division of the Treasury Department, and they were charged with overseeing the national banks. So she programmed in a language called COBOL, this mainstream computer language, and wrote software and inspected software that in turn inspected national banks.
That's
big geeky nerd.
And you got deep into computers.
Yeah, because
too.
Of her. I mean, she, you know, that was so fortunate for her to have discovered that. It really magnified her earning power, but it also positioned both of her kids. I have an older sister who lives in Michigan, and both of us, because of our mother, got early access to computers. She knew it was important. So we were one of the first households in our neighborhood to have a computer, to get online. I was doing bulletin boards and early internet before it became anywhere near front page news.
So you were describing earlier how your mother really wanted to give you a very complete education and some like historical rooting and what it means to be African-American. So she sent you to Sidwell Friends School, a fine school that the Obama children go to. Chelsea Clinton went there. But on weekends, you'd go to this like Afrocentric school and learn all about like African history and so on. Were you able to be the same person in both those settings? Or did you have to, like, adjust who you were? I mean, because a lot of us are, that's how we are. You know, you have different friends and you're slightly different with different friends. You're slightly different in different contexts.
Yeah, no, the code switching is a real thing. And I think there was a Baratunde from Newton Street who learn to walk those streets and navigate that world and be very comfortable with all the stuff that's happening in the street. And then there was the academic, library, studious, you know, high school newspaper Baratunde. And then there was the, like, Black Power Tunde that was also going down. And those worlds often collided. I remember I wrote a paper once for an English class that was extremely radical. It's the type of paper that I won't be president because I wrote this thing. Or it's one of those things they dig up, like Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, you should read. You reprint some of it in the book. You have to read some of it.
Yeah.
You have to read some of it from the book. It's very conspiracy theory.
So the title of this piece is The U.S. Propaganda Machine. And that's what I submitted to my English teacher.
Find a really good
excerpt. Yeah, let me jump to a hyper-inflammatory section, which... All right, this is fun. Now, my brothers and sisters, I will tell you, and what you also have to understand is I wrote this as if it were